You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm not sure any professor of philosophy has ever achieved rock star status, but you're about to meet one here today. My guest is Michael Sandel, and he teaches political philosophy at Harvard University. He's written an extraordinary book that's the focus of our discussion today. It's called The Tyranny of Merit: Can We Find the Common Good? It's been named a best book of the year by numerous respected news and literary outlets. The book was influential in last year's German elections, and I strongly suspect you'll hear more about it leading up to our elections this year in 2024. And yes, Professor Sandel was called a, quote, rock star moralist by Newsweek and, quote, the world's most influential living philosopher by New Statesman. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to come on today.
It's great to be with you, Robin.
You know, we're in uncharted territory for most Americans in terms of our political divide. I'm old enough to have lived through the 1960s, and I can fairly say this is worse. And this has been a topic my show has talked about a lot, but based on your book, you've got a lot to say of how we got here. How in the world did we get to this point?
It is pretty bad, Robin, and I think we have to look back over the past few decades to figure out how we got here. In recent decades, the divide between winners and losers has been deepening, poisoning our politics and driving us apart. I think this has partly to do with the widening inequalities of income and wealth that we've seen. But not only that, I think it also has to do with the changing attitudes toward success that have accompanied the rising inequality. Those who've landed on top have come to believe that their success is their own doing, the measure of their merit, and that they therefore deserve the full bounty that the market bestows upon them, and by implication, that those who struggle, those left behind, must deserve their fate as well. And this is what I describe in the book as the tyranny of merit, the tendency of elites, of the successful, to inhale too deeply their success, to forget the luck and good fortune that helped them on their way, and to forget their indebtedness to those who made their achievements possible, from family and teachers to neighborhood and community to the country and times in which they live. So I think this accounts, Robin, for this divide between winners and losers, the tendency of a to look down on those less credentialed than themselves. I think this is a big source of the resentments that have upended our politics and that have led to the polarization we still confront.
One of your major themes, and you start the book out talking about the college admission scandal, is the divide between those with college degrees and those without. And you take on some strongly held views here, which I think is what makes the book so interesting. Talk about that a little bit, the divide in educational status and how to a large degree, our colleges and universities have played a role in this.
Well, the divide between the educational divide, the diploma divide, is one of the most significant divides in politics today, Robin. Those with and those without college degrees tend to vote and also to see the world in very different ways. And I think part of what created this educational divide is connected to the emphasis on upward mobility through college credentials that we heard a lot about in recent decades during the era of globalization. We heard politicians across the political spectrum, Democrats and Republicans, responding to the wage stagnation and the job loss that globalization brought about by saying this, If you want to compete and win in the global economy, go to college. What you earn will depend on what you learn. You can make it if you try. We heard these slogans again and again. But what these politicians missed was the insult implicit in this advice. The insult was this: if you didn't go to college, and if you're struggling in the new economy, your failure must be your fault, not the fault of the policies that we, the politicians, the political parties, enacted over the past four decades. And what this forgets is that most Americans don't have a college degree. Nearly two-thirds do not. So it's folly to create an economy that sets as a necessary condition for dignified work and a decent life a four-year degree that most people don't have.
Well, if I could play the devil's advocate, I mean, I've seen a lot of people use that term or that language, go to college. And a lot of that is based on the fact that it very stark income differences of those who get degrees making more money and those who don't. And so their argument would be, we're just trying to help those attain a better life, more income by getting college degrees.
Right. And it's a good point. It's well-intentioned. There are a couple of problems. First, who gets in to top colleges and universities? We like to think that in a meritocracy, everyone really has an equal chance to succeed. We know that's not true. Someone did a study of the top 100 or so most selective colleges and universities across this country and found that 70% of the students who attend these places come from well-off families, top 25%. What percentage on these campuses are kids who come from low-income families? 3%. 3%. So we don't live up to the meritocratic ideals we profess. That's part of the problem. Here's another way of measuring this. At Ivy League and highly selective places, Harvard, Stanford, places like that, there are more students from families in the top 1% than there are students from the entire bottom half of the income scale put together. So the meritocracy is very imperfect. Chances are not equal. What your family income, family background has a lot to do with whether you even get a chance to go to competitive colleges and universities. But there's also a deeper problem, which is that, and I should say this first of all, so there's no misunderstanding of, encouraging people to get a college degree is a good thing. Broadening access to those who can't afford it is even better. So these are very important political projects. The mistake is to think or to assume that simply encouraging people to go to college is an adequate solution to the widening income gaps that we've seen, or to the wage stagnation, or to the job loss. That's the mistake. It's not an individual upward mobility through higher education is no adequate answer to the inequalities of income and wealth and power and opportunity and honor and recognition that we've seen in recent decades.
You took aim at another saying that's very common among elected officials, politicians, and that's the quote, work hard and play by the rules. And you went into detail about how many times that was repeated by politicians from mainly Democrats, I will say. Share with our listeners how you kind of deconstruct that and how that really doesn't is kind of mythical in its approach as well.
Well, the idea these slogans, work hard, play by the rules, you can make it if you try, what you earn depends on what you learn, on the face of it, they are inspiring, because they're encouraging people to better themselves so that they can compete more effectively for well-paying jobs in the economy. So on the face of it, the intention is good. But here's where it becomes damaging I refer to this political rhetoric as the rhetoric of rising, the rhetoric of rising. And too often, the rhetoric of rising is an excuse for not grappling directly with the structural inequalities in the economy that have put so many people out of work and that have left most working people with very, very few of the benefits that have come from the economic growth over the last four decades. Wages in real terms for the median worker have stagnated for more than four decades. So the rhetoric of rising has begun to ring hollow. And I think we saw this in 2016 with the election of Trump. Trump didn't use, and I am no defender of Donald Trump, but he did not use the rhetoric of rising. He had this blunt talk about winners and losers, making America great again. And what we saw this also in Brexit, in Britain, the vote for Brexit in 2016. There was a big diploma divide in the vote about whether to remain in the European Union, which those with advanced degrees overwhelmingly voted for, or whether to leave the European Union, which working class people, voters, voted for in large numbers, those who did not have university degrees. So the real question is whether the rhetoric of rising is an adequate answer to the wage stagnation and economic inequality that we've seen. And I don't think it is. It also has a corrosive effect on solidarity and the common good. Because the more people on top are encouraged to believe that their success is their own doing, they studied hard, they got a good degree, they did well on college entrance exams, they got a diploma, they got a professional degree maybe, the more we encourage the so-called winners to believe that their winnings are their due, the harder it is to forge a sense of common purpose and mutual obligation among democratic citizens, the sense that we are all in this together, indebted to one another for whatever success we may have achieved. That's the dark side of the rhetoric of rising.
And you had this resentment building among those without degrees that led to the election of Trump, who somewhat clumsily articulated what you say in the book when he said, I love lower educated people or lesser educated
people. I love
the
poorly educated, yeah, he declared after one primary victory. And it seemed an odd thing to say in a way, but he was touching on the fact that working people who didn't have the university diploma were turning out and voting for him in large part as a kind of backlash against elites who they felt looked down on them.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very delighted to have as my guest today the author of a book called The Tyranny of Merit. Can We Find the Common Good? It came out in 2020. His name's Michael J. Sandel. He's a political philosopher, teaches political philosophy at Harvard. And we've been talking a little bit about this book and his some of his theses in it, and it's a fascinating work. I keep thinking, you know, the tyranny of merit. When I saw the title, I first thought this is going to be interesting because it seems to me, anyway, our experts, so-called experts, haven't been doing a good job of late. You look at the Vietnam War, if you want to go back to the 60s, The Best and the Brightest, and you mentioned that book in this book. The Iraq War was, I think, by any measure, a failure. Our experts haven't been doing so well, and maybe they could use a little bit of humility and perhaps viewpoints of more the common folk out there.
Yes, I think that humility, and I emphasize this in the book, humility is a civic virtue we desperately need. And the governing elites, largely technocratic elites, who have predominated in recent decades, I think could use a dose of humility. Now, in recent decades, the meritocracy has intensified and rewarded those with advanced degrees and professional degrees. Just as you say, Robin, those elites have not governed very well, despite their lustrous credentials. Compare them to the elites who governed the United States, say, from 1940 to 1980. That generation won World War II, helped rebuild Europe and Japan, strengthened the welfare state, dismantled segregation, and presided over four decades of economic growth that flowed to rich and poor alike. Think now about the elites who have governed us since, during the four decades since. They brought us stagnant wages for most workers, inequalities of income and wealth not seen since the 1920s, the Iraq War, just as you mentioned, a 20-year war in Afghanistan, financial deregulation, the financial crisis of 2008, a decaying infrastructure, the highest incarceration rate in the world, a system of campaign finance that makes a mockery of democracy. That's the governing record of the highly credentialed elites who have governed in recent decades. It's worth noticing that one price that we pay for putting such emphasis on credentials as the basis for having a voice in our public life. If you look at Congress, now, remember, about 65% of Americans do not have a four-year college degree. What percentage of them serve in Congress? It's none in the Senate and 5% in the House. So the vast majority of Americans do not have a four-year degree. Virtually none of them serve in Congress. And the result is people with backgrounds in manual labor, working class backgrounds, roughly half the country, according to the Labor Department. What percentage of members of Congress had backgrounds in manual labor or working class backgrounds? Only 3%. 2% in Congress, only 3% in state legislature. So we have effectively disenfranchised a large swath of the population, given the premium we place in the job market, but also in terms of social recognition and prestige and honor on having lustrous university credentials, professional credentials. And this has generated, I think, an understandable backlash as the resentment has built.
And just to be clear, you're not suggesting merit has no role. I mean, you've made that very clear. But I'll give you the opportunity here to kind of expound on that. It has a role, but it's just been perhaps too prominent. That you do want to take merit into consideration when you go to a dentist, for example.
Absolutely. If I need a dentist to extract a tooth, I want a well-qualified dentist to perform it. If I'm flying in an airplane, I want a well-qualified pilot to be at the control. So merit, in the sense of having well-qualified people do important jobs, that's a good thing. But there's a difference between merit understood in that way and a meritocracy that says those with advanced degrees have a right to rule and to set the rules for the economy and for the rest of us. That's the problem. And what it misses, what it leads us to ignore, is the dignity of work. So what I'm really calling for is not to say we should hire unqualified people to be dentists or pilots. What I'm saying is that in our politics, in our public discourse, we should shift the focus from arming people for meritocratic competition and shift the focus instead to renewing the dignity of work, to recognize and honor and reward the contributions that everyone makes through the work they do, through the families they raise, through the communities they serve. And this means renewing the dignity of work and putting it at the center of our politics, which is a central theme of the book. So that's really, now people will disagree, and we can have debates about what it means in practice to strengthen and affirm the dignity of work. But I think that's a debate we should be having. And that debate has been ignored and overlooked by our preoccupation with equipping people to compete in a meritocratic competition, creating a divide between winners and losers, Robin.
It's not just our politics, as you point out, in pop culture. The working class, you point out, was starting to be portrayed as kind of limited in intelligence and bigoted. You mentioned Archie Bunker, and it wasn't that way before. And it seemed like there was just a point where things came together, not only in politics, but pop culture, where the working class was kind of looked at in a somewhat negative way.
Yeah, you see this with Archie Bunker, you see this with Homer Simpson, depicting, making working people the object of ridicule in popular culture, the butt of jokes. So it really runs quite deep. One concrete example of how we might begin to shift to an appreciation of the dignity of work could come from the whole experience we've been through with this pandemic. The pandemic highlighted inequalities that existed before the pandemic. But those of us with the luxury of working from home during the pandemic couldn't help but recognize how deeply we depend on workers we often overlook, not only the workers in the hospital, but I'm thinking also of delivery workers, warehouse workers, grocery store clerks, truck drivers, child care workers. These are not the best paid or most honored workers in our society. But during the pandemic, we began describing them as essential workers. I don't know that anyone during the pandemic was referring to hedge fund managers as essential workers. So this could be an opening for a broader public debate about how to bring their pay and recognition into better alignment with the importance of the work they do. At least I hope so.
I thought it was fascinating, and I really enjoyed that section of the book on the dignity of work, because I think it's spot on where we've gotten away from looking at all the jobs that are done that are meaningful. Just because you have a college degree and doesn't mean that the person flipping burgers or the person changing your tire or whatever isn't doing something meaningful. I was brought up in a working class family, and I was always felt that way. But my point is that one person that did get this, and it goes back quite a while, was Bobby Kennedy, which I thought was interesting.
He did get this. When he ran for president in 1968, he articulated this very powerfully. He's one of my political heroes. He put it this way. He said, fellowship, community, shared patriotism, these essential values do not come from just buying and consuming goods together. They come instead, he said, from dignified employment at decent pay, the kind of employment that enables us to say, I helped to build this country. I am a participant in its great public ventures. So Robert F. Kennedy connected the dignity of work with a sense of community and a sense of that we are all in this together. We easily these days fall into the assumption that the money people make is the measure of their contribution to the common good. But this is a mistake. And challenging this assumption is one of my main goals in the book, The Tyranny of Merit. Another person who articulated this was Martin Luther King Jr. Just before he was assassinated, he had traveled to Memphis, Tennessee, where he was speaking to a group of striking sanitation workers, garbage collectors. And what he told them was this. He said, the person who picks up our garbage is panel analysis as significant as the physician. Because if he doesn't do his job, diseases are rampant. And then he added, all labor has dignity. And this is a lesson we need to learn again and again. Perhaps the experience of the pandemic will remind us of it. But so much of the pressure in our public culture, never mind our politics, is in the opposite direction. We're just assuming that the people who make the most money must be the ones who are the most deserving and who are contributing most. I want to challenge that assumption. I think we need to challenge that assumption. If we're to begin to heal the division, the polarization that afflicts our politics and our social life.
Michael, I only have like a minute left here, and this is a big question to try to wrap up in a minute, and I apologize for that, but is this something we just have to talk about and debate, or are there some concrete things legislatively, or what are your thoughts on that?
I think we need to consider concrete measures. In policy terms, we should consider, for example, how the tax system skews our understanding of what's really of value. For example, we should debate, why is it that earnings from capital gains and dividends should be taxed at a lower rate than earnings from work, earnings from labor? Because that's what our tax system does. Is that a good thing? Is it defensible? And if not, maybe we should change it. But I also think we need changes in our civil society, because part of the problem with inequality and the reason it's been corrosive of our civic life is that those who are affluent and those of modest means live increasingly separate lives. We live and work, shop and play in different places. We send our kids to different schools. This isn't good for democracy, because democracy requires class mixing institutions, public places and common spaces that bring us together in the course of our everyday lives. We can encounter people from different social backgrounds, because this is how we come to care for the common good.
Well, this has been a joy to have you on, and I can't recommend this book highly enough to our listeners. It's called The Tyranny of Merit, Can We Find the Common Good? It's the most provocative book I've read in a while, and as my listeners know, I read in quite a bit and have a lot of authors on, but the author here is Michael Sandel, who's a professor at Harvard, and I encourage folks to learn more about Michael and pick up a copy of the book. And Michael, thank you again so much for being a guest today on Heartland Politics.
Thank you, Robin.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org. in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
You got this, girl.
Love Girls, the podcast, is all about storytelling and empowerment.
Our mission is to share a space for women and girls to talk about the stuff that matters to them most. Love speaks to the support we give each other as we search for our own path to success.
L, we can lead the way.
O,
overcome barriers.
V,
value each other.
E,
and empower each other. That's love.
Because every girl has a story.
And our stories matter.